So as many of you know by now, and some of you don't, I've been spending this year doing a series on what's called the Satipatthana, which is a Buddhist text, which is essentially a manual for meditation. It's not a religious thing per se. It has, if I've counted correctly, 53 different techniques for meditation in it, and we've just been slowly going through that. Today I want to look at a paragraph that is repeated over and over throughout the text and is meant to be, it's an instruction meant to be followed for every technique that is taught in there. And I'm going to read it. I'm actually going to read from the beginning of the text for those of you who haven't been with us all along, so that you can get it in context. So it begins, "Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, being the Buddha, was living in the Kuru country in a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. There he addressed the monks thus. 'Monks, venerable sir,' they said. And the Blessed One said this." This is how many of the texts begin. I like to call them the Buddha stories. "Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas." Now, we looked at that paragraph in detail a couple months ago, and basically it's saying that the satipatthanas are like realms or areas in which you can apply mindfulness. There are four general ones that are divided up into lots of more detail, and this is not the only path to freedom from suffering, but it is a path that if you follow it, eventually you will achieve that. That's basically what this paragraph is saying. So this is the direct path, the four satipatthanas. What are the four? "Here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the rest of the world. In regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to the mind, he abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. And in regard to the dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world." Now, we've also been through this paragraph. I apologize for some of the Pali words, Pali being the language of the Buddha. There's some words that just don't translate well into English, and so when we come across those, I will discuss them. I try to avoid foreign lingo, but sometimes it's difficult to avoid that. So the point of this paragraph is that there are these four areas that we can be mindful of. They are the body, feelings in terms of feeling tone, so pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, mind states, and the dhammas are something that we'll deal with later in the year. That's a bunch of lists of different qualities and hindrances and things that you can cultivate. So those are the four areas of mindfulness. And then the next paragraph jumps right into the body and the first practice of the body. And I won't read the whole thing, but he says, how does a monk do this in regard to the body? He breathes in and he knows that he's breathing in. He breathes out and he knows that he's breathing out. And this is given in some detail and with a simile, which the Buddha liked to use. So essentially, that was the first technique, is simply observing the breath. Breathing in, you know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, you know that you're breathing out. Then we have the refrain, which is what I want to talk about tonight. So he's just said, this is how a monk contemplates the body, breathing in and breathing out. In this way, in regard to the body, he abides contemplating the body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, or he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. Or he abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or he abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body, or he abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. And then there's a little bit more that we're going to look at next week. And then this is how, in regard to the body, he abides contemplating the body. Then you have another technique about postures, and then you have this refrain again. This is how a monk contemplates the postures, internally or externally, arising, passing away, in both. And then you have another technique, maybe the body parts. Some of you were here for that when we took our body apart and contemplated what our bodies are made of. And then following that, you have the same refrain. You contemplate your body parts internally and externally, both internally and externally, arising, passing away, both arising and passing away. And every technique through this entire writing, you have this refrain. And when you get into feelings, you are by contemplating feelings internally and externally, arising and passing away. So we can assume there's something significant about these qualities by which we should be contemplating. So I thought it would be useful to look at them. And we're just going to look at the first two sort of categories, the internal, external, and the arising, passing away. And then there's some more, I don't know whether to say equally unclear or just as fun for next week. The fact that it's there so frequently means that every technique that you do has these six different ways of contemplating. And we're going to start with internal and external. And this is first on the list, so we can assume this is an important distinction. But it's not actually that obvious when you try and figure it out. You know, the first thing that you think, especially when you're in the body, is maybe internal and external means physically internal. You know, you've got your heartbeat and your indigestion and your stuff. And then there's the physically external, which is the skin sensations and smell and taste. Or it could mean internally triggered or externally triggered. I talk about this from time to time when it comes to emotions. You could have an external sensation if something falls on you, you feel it. That's external. But if you're feeling your heartbeat, then that's not externally caused, so that would be internal. But that doesn't actually make sense when you start looking at the other three categories, which we haven't looked at yet, but pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, mind states, and the dhammas. Sometimes you're looking specifically at something internal, subjective, and then it doesn't make sense to look at it both internally and externally, because the instructions have already got you looking at it internally. So there's something more to this. There's quite a lot of discussion amongst modern mindfulness teachers what this means, but Analio, who is the guy who wrote the book that I forgot today, that I've been reading from off my phone, who is recognized really as a scholar of this particular text, looking at how the words are used in other contexts and how other words are not used in this context to support different understandings, his conclusion is that what we're actually supposed to be doing is looking internally in terms of our experience and then externally in terms of the experience of others, which is sort of weird because that, at least for me, that goes a bit against what my understanding of the practice of mindfulness is. It, you know, for me, it's observing my experience and understanding that my perception brings in a bunch of stories and interpretations and this and that. But for the suggestion that I should now be observing the breathing in and breathing out of someone else is sort of weird. And yet that seems to be what this means. That I know when I'm breathing in, I know when I'm breathing out. I observe that in myself internally. I can actually observe when other people are breathing in and breathing out. You know, I just have to look at them. It might be very subtle, but I can see it. It gets a little more confusing if you're, or it's easy actually, if you're looking at postures, for example. We've talked about the transition between sitting and standing, sitting, standing, lying down, walking. That's obviously a lot easier to see other people doing it than maybe knowing what their internal, you know, if they've got indigestion or not. And yet we are asked to observe in this way, to observe others. It almost seems like we need to be psychic to do this. And then when we come to things like feeling pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, if someone's sitting still in meditation, how do we know what they're feeling? Well, perhaps it's not so useful to observe that during formal meditation, but you can observe that with people out and about. And there are actually texts in which it is explained how you can recognize somebody else's state of mind from their actions. I wish I had brought it to quote it, but there's one place where it's described how you can tell if a monk is angry by the way he eats or by the way he walks. So we're not asked to be psychic here, but we are asked to observe and to become skillful at noticing other people and what's going on with other people. Finally, we're enjoined to observe both at the same time, both my physical sensations, if that's what I happen to be doing, and what other people are feeling or appear to be feeling, as far as I can tell. And this is where it really comes together and starts to make a little sense, because other people have feelings just like I do. I'm breathing in and breathing out, and you're breathing in and breathing out. I may be experiencing anger, and then I can see someone else is experiencing anger. So contemplating both together, especially if you're out and about, as I say, it's a little harder to do in the formal meditation session, but you start to see that other people are just like you. And initially, this is great. It leads to compassion and loving kindness, because you might start to empathize with people because you become more skilled at noticing what's going on with them. But the further you get into it, you start recognizing that there's actually not really anything different about you and other people. You know, if you're going to do, was it last week we talked about the charnel ground meditations, meditating on dead bodies as they decay and turn to dust, and the fact that my body too will do that. Well, your bodies also will do that. Eventually, we will all just be dust. And for that matter, we have all been created out of the same dust. The stardust, as Carl Sagan would say. The only difference is that this physical spatial distinction, and your stimuli are working in your brain and my stimuli are working in my brain, but we're still made out of the same stuff and we're ending up in the same stuff. So this contemplation internally and externally in whatever technique you're doing is going to slowly bring you in contact with this unity, the sameness of us all, the lack of difference, the lack of self, the lack of anything. We've talked about this a lot. Anything specifically me, because you and I are the same stuff. It causes different responses in our brains because the stimuli are slightly different, But our brains are made out of the same kind of cells. So there's nothing really different about us. So I think that's why this distinction between internal and external in terms of actually me and you is important, because eventually it isn't me and you. It's just what is. In this present moment, meditation happens. You know, there's no distinction. The next pair of things is arising and passing. And again, remember, this would be whatever technique you choose. I'm watching my breath, I'm watching my actions, I'm contemplating my death. I can do this noticing the arisings in my experience, noticing the passings, or noticing both at the same time. If internal and external sort of brought us in touch with the unity of everything, arising and passing will bring us into touch with the impermanence of everything, which is those are two of the three what they call marks of existence. No self, not selfness, no thing is one mark. And impermanence, nothing stays the same, everything changes. If you can experience that, that can be very transformative. We can understand that, but we need to experience it. So we begin with noticing arising, so things come into being. Say, take something simple like breathing. Notice how your breath begins out of stillness. Breath begins. Your out-breath begins out of that pause at the end of your in-breath. If you're moving, you're noticing your postures, there is an arising of intention to move and then emotion. And you can come to really notice that change from sitting. Well, there's sitting to standing, but there's also sitting to knowing that you're about to move. And so there's this arising of the motion. So for some time you can observe the arising of experience in whatever technique you're using. When you've gotten a handle on that, you can notice the passing. You know, your breath begins out of nothing, but eventually your lungs are full and it stops. And that breath is over. And you can notice the passing of things. If you've got physical sensations, you may not notice when they started, but you can stick with them until they pass away. And again, with the body parts or the death contemplation, eventually we will pass away. We arise out of, well, how far back do you go? You know, you arise out in conception, but you wouldn't be there if it weren't for your parents existing, who exist because of their parents. And, you know, so we arise out of something and then we pass into something. So this arising and passing can be a lot of fun to play with and significant to notice. And there can actually be, there are states that sometimes you get into where all you're doing is noticing the passing. It's like everything is passing. You don't notice when things are starting, but you become really sensitive to things passing or to things arising. And then you can look at both together and you discover that your entire experience, something is arising and something is passing. Or actually, lots of things are arising and passing. And in fact, everything is arising and passing. Even as it's arising, it's already passing. Because as soon as it started, it's already on its way to finishing, even as it's arising. So by observing what you observe arising, passing, or both arising and passing, you can get a direct experience, a knowledge that's more than an intellectual understanding of this impermanence. And that can be very freeing. I think we've talked about that too, the freedom of, it sounds sort of scary, everything's going to pass away. But at the same time, it means we don't have to worry about clinging on to things, and we can enjoy things while they're here because we know they're going to pass away. I'm going to pass away. So we do both internally and externally. We do arising and passing. You can notice how your awareness of yourself arises out of distraction, perhaps. You're off in monkey mind, and then you become aware of yourself again. There's an arising right there. I don't need to keep on repeating it. It's fun to explore that, and so that's what we'll be doing in our meditation in a moment. Next week, we're going to be looking at the second half of that paragraph. But what we'll do today, in our first meditation period, I will guide you just with some reminders of these pairs of things. Again, remember, it'll be harder to observe other people during this formal meditation, so maybe we'll stick with mostly with the arising and passing. Yes?
Well, and just, I guess, a distinction I would ask for the internal, external.
Mm-hmm.
And that you used an example of, you know, feeling anger and kind of seeing anger in others.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that the noticing in others would be like a very objective noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And because otherwise it seems like you could really tilt into the place of projection and like, you know, putting an experience on
yes.
someone instead of just keeping out, oh, I noticed that their face is flushed or that like their chest is rising and falling, but not needing to like go past that and putting like a label
yeah.
on the actual experience, but like just what you're observing.
Right. I think that's a very good comment, and which is why it feels a little bit uncomfortable, doesn't it? Because we're taught all along not to project stories on people. So it would be important to remember actually what you've said is good, their face is flushed. Just leave it there. But if, you know, perhaps you know a person is angry, perhaps it's conventionally obvious, you still need to know yourself that you are applying a conventionally obvious label to something that you don't know whether or not it's true. Yeah, it's sort of a gray area because we want to create the compassion from knowing that everyone goes through the same thing. But we don't want to make assumptions or create the stories or add the labels that we've been spending all of our practice learning not to do. So that's a very good point. And although there are teachings in these writings about, like I mentioned, you can tell if a monk is angry by how he eats. And personally, I was a little surprised to read that was there. And maybe that's something that we need to be a little bit more advanced to be able to feel with objectivity. The physical aspects, the motions, and things that you know, somebody says, "Ow, that hurt," then you know they're in pain. Those are going to be a little safer for us to observe. But I appreciate you bringing that up. I don't want to be encouraging people to make assumptions and label people with emotions that we don't know whether or not that's actually what's going on.